Wednesday, May 21st. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for being with us on this cloudy, chilly May day. Today on the show, we're going to do a deep dive on youth incarceration in Philadelphia. Philadelphia detains more young people than any other major American city, and it's not even close. So today we're going to explain why, and we're going to explore what the alternatives might be. There are a lot of things swirling around this topic, including an investigation into Philadelphia's Department of Human Services. We'll get into that with a pair of experts in our main segments today. And here's our question for you. Should the city consider alternatives to locking kids up? And what should those alternatives be? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, hello. Drop a comment right there in the YouTube chat.
Yeah, so many questions around this. Avi, when I was a reporter, I followed a young man who got incarcerated or adjudicated at 12 for a pretty vicious fight with his little brother. He celebrated his 13th, 14th, and 15th birthdays detained. And when he got out, he was a changed young person. His mother said they couldn't get him out of the system. And so I have so many questions about how this type of thing happens to so many young people in our region. So I look forward to hearing the solutions. You know, I love our listeners coming up with all sorts of ideas and just help us really think about this. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
And criminal justice was on the ballot yesterday.
It was.
In Philadelphia. So let's go into our trio of local news stories. You're kicking us off, Cherry.
Yes. The results of Tuesday's Pennsylvania primary are in. The big local race, as Avi alluded, it was the race for Philadelphia District Attorney and Larry Krasner, incumbent.
Didn't even need a drum roll for that.
No.
That wasn't drum roll worthy.
Yeah, beat Judge Patrick Dugan pretty handily, garnering around 64% of the vote. Here's Krasner's last night, soon after his win. Take a listen.
When you believe in the potential of human beings to change or to avoid the crime in the first place, you end up on the 20th day of May, Election Day 2025, with the smallest number of homicides in over 50 years.
And, you know, like you said, it was not a surprise. I mean, Krasner was able to handily win 4 years ago when we had an all-time high for homicides. And, of course, that rate has been down considerably. He's now the favorite, that is Krasner, for the general election and will very likely get a third term because at this point there is no GOP challenger. The GOP now wants to nominate Dugan to run in the general.
Who just lost to Krasner.
Yeah, but his campaign has indicated that he's very unlikely to do that. Also, Philadelphians approved all three ballot measures that were up for consideration. And if you look over in Downingtown, another big election that made some headlines. Erica Dusso made history by winning the city's Democratic mayoral primary and could become Pennsylvania's first openly transgender mayor. She will face Republican Richard Bryant in the November general election. Details on all the elections, including statewide judicial races, are available at whyy.org/election. Our folks were up working on
Always.
On election day, even though it was a sleepy election, lower turnout than we had, of course, in November for the presidential.
And it looks like lower turnout than even 4 years ago, which is also an off-year non-mayoral election. So it didn't seem like people were particularly jazzed up about.
We tried to jazz them up yesterday, though.
Yeah, we tried.
A little bit.
We did our part. You know, it's funny. A couple reactions. One, they always call us Negadelphia, but these ballot measures always get yes, yes, yes.
They do.
People like to select yes on the ballot measures in Philadelphia. You mentioned the margin that Krasner won by. This is what I was watching because I expected that he would win. 64-36. The last time he ran as an incumbent, he won about 66-33.
Yeah.
Not a lot of change in the margin, right? And so what does that say? Because the conditions were totally different this time.
Yep.
The murder rate was far lower. He had a different challenger, right? And so when you see that stability, you kind of ask, is that because Krasner's coalition is really sort of stuck at that number and can't be budged? It's about him. Or is it that's what an incumbent will basically always get in a normal Democratic primary election in Philadelphia, regardless of whether it's Krasner or anyone else.
Yeah, especially the people who tend to vote in these off-year elections. Sure. Is just kind of stuck there.
Story number two.
Mm-hmm.
And let me preface this one, because we are going to have a great Inquirer reporter on the show today. We really respect the work that they do at the Inquirer. We couldn't do shows like today without the good folks at the Inquirer. That said, bit of an oopsie. At the Philadelphia Inquirer. A 56-page supplement published by the Inquirer and other newspapers across the country included AI-generated content. And what's more, that AI-generated content included a summer reading list with made-up books, such as one titled The Last Algorithm. So how does a recommendation for a fake book end up in a supplement in the Philadelphia Inquirer? Well, the supplement was produced by a syndication company called King Features. King Features distributes comics and other stuff that winds up in papers all over the country. King Features, if you follow the chain here, hires freelancers to produce this content. And apparently one of its freelancers used AI to write this fake reading list with fake books on it. So there you go. A freelancer somewhere out in the country, I think he's in Chicago, uses AI, and somehow it ends up printed in your Philadelphia Inquirer.
Yeah, and by the way, Gabrielle Escobar, the Inquirer's editor and senior vice president, said using AI to produce content is a, quote, violation of our own internal policies and a serious breach. King Features also says it had a strict AI policy. And I looked up the freelancer, whose name I won't mention, you know, for various reasons, but the guy has been, you know, graduated from college in 91.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's not a spring chicken.
He's not a spring chicken. He's been doing this for years. And has a master's degree, by the way.
To his credit, so, issued a strong mea culpa.
Yeah,
he did not try to, like, like, play it off.
He did. He said, oops. He basically, like, feels really bad about this and should have double-checked his AI. So, I don't know. We're out of school right now, but I would use this as an example to my students as to why you shouldn't use it. You really need to do the work.
I agree. It shows you the perils of AI and using AI, because there are these hallucinations that come with AI. However, I think to put it all on the writer maybe misses some of the structural
problem
here.
Yeah, there needs to be some editors.
This is not... So I think there are still copy editors at newspapers and, you know, syndication outlets like this. But are there fact checkers? Because a copy editor is not going to necessarily catch
this.
True. They're looking for commas and periods. You need someone to actually check the veracity
to
of
do
things.
The work.
And there are very few of those left just across the ecosystem. It sort of falls piecemeal on reporters and editors to do that work. And so I do think this points to some larger issues, that sort of one freelancer using AI in a bad way gets all the way through to the finish line.
And you're right. There should have been multiple checks in there that could have been placed, but they weren't.
And I don't know a lot about how the syndication system works. Like, I don't work in that world, but it does strike me as like a little bit of a warning sign there.
Yeah.
Whew. Speaking of dystopian futures, story number three, Jerry.
Yes. Remember the webcam gate scandal in Lower Marion from about 2010?
You asking me if
I'm
remember?
Wondering, just the folks in, you know, in the audience.
Oh, that's just
I don't know if you remember that. Well, it's part of
the generic.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Do you remember? Well, it's part of a 4-part docuseries on Prime Video. It's called Spy High.
Good title.
And it digs into the stories behind that story, right? And if you don't recall, the webcam gate scandal took place when students in the school district were secretly photographed through their school-issued laptops. The district had issued more than 2,300 laptops to students. The computers had the security software that allowed the district to activate the devices remotely to track the location, and that would trigger webcams, which took screenshots of the laptops from the laptops in 15-minute intervals. And
basically, the laptops were spying on the kids.
Yeah, they were spying on the kids in their homes. And apparently, the district had collected about 56,000 images. And all of this is laid out in that docuseries. And here's a clip from an episode one where students describe what it was like in class the day that the news broke. Take a listen.
When I came into school, it was a very normal day. And I think it was maybe second or third period when I started to hear some talk.
It just escalated so quickly.
It went from a couple people in class to like literally everybody. And it was like exciting. But by the end of the day, the principal got on the loudspeaker and I remember just sinking into my chair.
Wow. I don't remember this time in the region. I was pretty new to Philly at that time. But I'm like, wow, this is at the beginning, you know, of schools really using laptops and being in kids' homes. And so, I mean, apparently there were lawsuits, all types of allegations of privacy violations and, you know, accusations of illegal surveillance here.
Yeah, you know, I do vaguely recall it at the time and then heard about it in the subsequent years, and certainly a big scandal. I don't know how much we've learned from it, right? Because I still think districts sometimes transparently, the problem with this one is people didn't even know it was happening, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes transparently say, yeah, we're monitoring kids' social media for, you know, bad behavior and threats and things like that. So that still happens. I think it'll still continue to happen. This is part of our technological future.
Yeah, and reality, seriously. But the Inquirer did a pretty decent write-up on it where they took five takeaways from it. Might want to check it out.
Sure. And apparently this just in, multiple major news outlets report that the proposed ban of the tush push did not receive enough votes to pass the NFL owners meeting today. So look forward to Jalen Hurts and the Philadelphia Eagles bullying teams across the goal line for at least another season. The tush push lives on. Breaking Long news there from Studio 2 on WHYY. When we come back, we're going to talk about youth incarceration in Philadelphia. Philadelphia detains far more young people than any other major American city. Our question for you, should the city consider alternatives to locking kids up? What should those alternatives be? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Philadelphia detains more young people per capita than any major American city. In fact, its rate of confinement is more than double the second-ranked city. So why are we such an outlier?
An ongoing Inquirer investigation tries to unpack that. It also looks at conditions inside youth detention facilities where there are regular reports of abuse. If these facilities aren't working as intended, what's a better way? Well, we're going to ask that question and many more to Samantha Melamed, investigative reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Samantha has written a series of stories on youth detention in Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Nicole L., Chief of the Children and Youth Justice Unit at the Defender Association of Philadelphia, with us in studio. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
And our question this hour to you, our listeners, is this. Should the city consider alternatives to locking kids up? If so, what should they be? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your questions or comments in the chat.
Samantha, I wanted to start with you. Why did you pursue this story in this series? And what surprised you when you started to dig into it?
Yeah, so, I mean, just briefly, I think it might be helpful to start with a little bit of background, which is that, you know, across the country, there was so many more youth were being detained every year, you know, back through, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And there's been a huge movement nationwide to move kids out of institutions because of the level of abuse that was happening. And because across pretty much every measure, education, recidivism, mental health, you know, all sorts of things, it was really harmful. And so Philly made a huge improvement too. But then, you know, during the pandemic, the juvenile detention center was extremely overcrowded. If you remember, the city had sued the state to get them to take on the young people who were being sentenced and who were waiting for their placements. And there was a sense of a lot of turmoil in the system, and it was not really being covered. So I decided to take on this project. I also got a grant from the Stoneleigh Foundation to do it, and began trying to understand how we stack up, because there's almost no data out there that sort of compares different cities, and you know, to understand more about the conditions within the facilities.
And that was the most surprising thing to me mm-hmm. about reading this. It's sort of like two surprises packed into one. One is that Philly's rates of detention are so much higher than other major American cities. And then second, that the number of young people in detention has actually fallen sharply from its peak. And so essentially what's happened, and tell me if I'm right, is that Philly's rate has fallen, but not nearly as fast as other places.
Yeah, correct. I mean, we've fallen behind, essentially.
Yeah.
We've made improvements, but we've fallen behind. And when you look at the percentage of kids who are charged, who are detained here, it's way higher. So, you know, we used to account for like 25% of the kids who were detained in Pennsylvania each year, and now it's like half or from
right.
Philly.
Yeah, I saw those numbers. Philadelphia is home to 12% of Pennsylvania teens, but is responsible for nearly half of all juveniles in detention in the state. What is Philadelphia doing that's different from other cities or municipalities that is causing the number to be so high?
I mean, I think, you know, Nicole maybe can answer this better, but I think, you know, obviously there is crime here. There is serious crime. And when you look at the cases that are charged in Philadelphia, there are like 3/4 of them are or more are felonies. So, you know, there are a lot of serious cases to be dealt with. But I think a lot of it also has to do with how decisions are being made. There's, you know, a reluctance to release kids, even though it's, you know, they're pretrial, they haven't necessarily been convicted of anything, and many of those cases may later be dropped. And then we're also sending kids to placements for much longer. Basically, like, no place else in Pennsylvania is it's very normal to send kids to a placement and then say once they complete the program they can come home.
Sure.
But we tend to send kids for like a set period of time of a year, 2 years, even 3 years. And so the state is, you know, pointing out that we're really an outlier in that regard.
Yeah. And Nicole, I wanted to get you in that conversation because, you know, Samantha mentioned you may know a little bit more about this. And I want to talk about the system because it's very different in the juvenile system than it is with adults. Can you sort of explain to us some of the differences and how that results in more kids being locked up than in other places?
Sure. So for kids, we have laws that say that they should not be detained unless they are a danger to themselves, unless they are a danger to others, theoretically a danger to property. And as long as there's somebody who's willing to take them home, they should come home. And that's different from the adult side, which has its own criteria based on like bail standards and things like that about whether or not kids or adults are supposed to be able to go home. What's happening in Philadelphia? And so I think first we have to acknowledge that there's kind of two populations of children. There are the pretrial children, and then there are the children who are post-trial.
Mm-hmm.
We do see, as Sam was talking about, a number of kids who are held pretrial. So that would be at the initial hearing where they are seen by a hearing officer, and that person decides, is this child able to go home? Is there somebody who's willing to have them home? That is the initial hearing that kids have when they are first charged and they're deciding whether or not they can go home or not. Then we have a second population of children. So this is kids who are already on some sort of court supervision. Let's say they're on juvenile court probation and they violate in some way. So let's say they're on GPS and they are supposed to come home at 7:30 and they come home at 7:45. We have to determine in that situation whether or not they should be held for that violation.
How serious is the violation, essentially, and whether they should be held?
Not even necessarily that, because what we are doing in Philadelphia is when kids are put on probation, we have judges and hearing officers who are saying, well, the first time they violate in any way, they need to be held. So it could be, you know.
And that's up to the discretion.
That's up to the discretion.
Of the adults here. Correct. It's not like baked into the penal code at all.
It is not baked into the penal code.
And it could be a minor infraction, yes. And they end up back in detention.
Yes, and they're back in detention. So you have the pre-trial population in detention, and then you have the post-trial population in detention. And there's ways to cut down on the kids in detention for both of those populations, right? So pre-trial, we really have to stop looking at kids and making the assumption that they're dangerous, that their parents can't take care of them, that it's not appropriate for them to go home, especially when we're talking about, so we throw out the term felony and people are like, that must mean gunpoint robbery. But like a felony could mean a car that was stolen where nobody was injured.
Mm-hmm.
Should that kid go home? Most people are going to say, I don't think that that kid should be holding a spot at the JJSC. They shouldn't be in secure detention.
Mm-hmm.
But we hold a lot of those kids anyway.
Can I ask you, though, so this is where I get a little bit confused, because if the inflection point here is all these individual adult decision makers who are basically saying, hey, this kid's good to go home, this kid isn't, you would think there would be more variety in the outcomes because those people are not working in concert with one another. So you would think there would be some judge in Pittsburgh who's very harsh and some judge in Philadelphia who's very lenient, and they would be sort of evenly distributed across the system. That's how my statistical brain thinks about it. And yet you have these outlier statistics in Philadelphia. So is it just that all the judges in Philadelphia have the same mentality? Their mentality all shifted at the same time because we're seeing what's happening in Philadelphia is not happening elsewhere. I don't understand how you get these systemic results when there's all these individual decision makers who are seemingly working in isolation.
Well, the issue is whether there is a larger message that the individual decision makers are getting that influences the decisions that they're making.
And getting from whom? Like, who are the inputs here?
So there could be a lot of inputs, right? Inputs from the media. So we have to remember that hearing officers are not elected, but judges are.
Yeah.
And so I think it's fair to say that most judges do not want to see their name in the paper, sure, for letting out a child who then goes to commit serious
horrible
crimes. Yeah. And then, okay, well, I'm up for retention and somebody's pointing the finger at me and saying, mm-hmm, I let that person go.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other issues at play in Philadelphia, right? So we have a different racial demographic,
yeah,
than they do in other parts of the state. And so you have this perception by, I'll just say, some people in the system, people outside of the system, about what we call Philly kids.
Right.
And we know that Philly kids are a code for Black children from certain, mm-hmm, areas of the city. And
sorry, Nicole, but I would just imagine all that stuff has been true. And I'm trying to understand what's changed such that Philadelphia is not keeping pace with the other municipalities, because I take everything that you say as the potential cause, but I'm wondering why just in the last handful of years there seems to be some sort of shift where Philly is not following the trend that we see elsewhere.
So I think an explanation for that is probably our overuse of GPS. I think that is a huge part of this.
That's an ankle monitor. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so what we are seeing is when you have this group of kids who people feel sometimes legitimately that they are more at risk of like gun violence in the city that you might not see in the suburbs or whatever, they're like, well, we have to monitor these kids. We're going to put the kid on GPS. Okay, well, now we have the child on GPS. Okay, well, now the child violates. They don't come home at 7:30. They come home at 7:45. Now there's a first violation hold in their case. Mm-hmm. They are brought into custody.
So the surveillance of it.
So there's the surveillance, but mm-hmm, you have the additional surveillance because of the perception,
yeah,
of who these children are. And so what neighborhoods they're coming from and what the color of their skin is does play a role,
yeah,
in whether or not people think that they should come home.
So the baseline conditions interacting with the technological change may be, in your mind, an explanation for why Philly is kind of diverging from the norm a bit here.
Yes, and I think that you would definitely see that there are more children on GPS in Philadelphia than you will see across the state.
Yeah,
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, when you look at states or other jurisdictions that have made really drastic reductions in the number of kids incarcerated, you also see a lot of state and local stakeholders working together, and there's a real movement around it. And that just hasn't happened here.
Mm. Yeah, there hasn't been that political will. By the way, I wanted to kind of piggyback on that and Samantha, bring out some of the stats from your reporting. Black kids are 9 times more likely to be charged with a crime, according to your reporting, 13 times more likely to be detained while waiting for court, and 20 times more likely to be sentenced to placement in state institutions. Was this very surprising to you, Samantha, in doing this reporting? And then I want you to follow up with what has been the impact on some of these kids when you have these large number of children going in, and how does detention impact them?
I don't think it's surprising. I mean, I think that the sheer number is surprising. I believe in 2023, there were 297 kids from Philly who were sent to state placements and 2 were white. So, I mean, like the extremeness of that was surprising. But, you know, I mean, I think what it says is just a replication of what's happening across our entire criminal justice system and, you know, obviously so many facets of life. But, you know, I think, obviously people look at young Black kids in Philly and, you know, if they do something, you know, that, you know, might be seen as, you know, a reckless, youthful act in the suburbs, if it was a white kid in the suburbs in Philly, you know, people look at that kid different.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, talk about the impact because a lot of times kids are put in, as Nicole said, for sometimes minor violations. They're detained. And I know, Samantha, you've talked to a number of people. What's happening inside once you get in there? And how does it impact kids who are put in detention?
Yeah. I mean, so obviously, there's a huge and really troubling history of abuse in these facilities, and we've seen so many facilities shut down over the years because of physical, sexual, and other types of abuse happening among the kids. And the Philadelphia Juvenile Justice Services Center, which is where about 150 kids are detained in West Philly, is not an exception. And you know, I heard from kids about staff bribing them with cheesesteaks to assault other kids. And we've heard from the youth ombudsman's office about the long-term isolation kids were put in. So that really has profound effects on kids. And, you know, like a lot of them, when they come home, they really struggle to readjust and to get back on track. And, you know, we see really bad recidivism numbers as a result.
Just want to make sure we understand that, our listeners do. Adults telling children that they will give them a cheesesteak and look the other way if they beat up another kid in the facility.
That's what the kids said. And also, you know, I did hear that from a former staffer, and you can see in at least one DHS, that's a state regulator, in at least one report, they described an incident where they observed on camera, not with the cheesesteak, but yeah, where they observed camera, a staffer appearing to slow walk a response to a fight. So, yeah. And I mean, as you guys know, DHS is currently on Philadelphia's Department of Human Services is currently on a provisional license. And so is the Juvenile Detention Center because of another fight that happened.
Just
there.
On that point, because I want to make sure we get this in. Mm-hmm. So we haven't gotten to the details of that investigation and why the license was downgraded yet. It has to do with alleged interference into an investigation in the conditions of the detention center that you talked about. We did invite DHS to appear on this show. They declined, but did send a statement about that investigation. Let me read it. We are confident that the Philadelphia Department of Human Services did not violate any state law or regulation. Therefore, the city intends to appeal the Commonwealth's decision to issue a provisional certificate of compliance to the Philadelphia Department of Human Services. The basis for the state's action has nothing to do with the care of children. The care and safety of children has always been and will remain our utmost priority. Moreover, as it does in all investigations, the City of Philadelphia is fully cooperating with PADHS and actively working to provide PADHS with all relevant documents as requested. In fact, the city has timely produced over 20,000 pages in response. Additionally, PADHS has open access at all times to the Philadelphia Department of Human Services and has looked at any records maintained by the City DHS. We also invited the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office to appear on this program, and they declined as well.
By the way, I wanted to read a comment. We have Sadiqa on YouTube who says, the kids in JJSC sent to placement are often sent to high security facilities, basically jail. for oftentimes minor issues. I volunteer there. I hear their stories. And speaking of stories, I want to bring in someone who has been in Philadelphia's juvenile detention system. And joining us now, we have Rodney Gardner. He was in Philadelphia's Juvenile Justice Services Center in 2017 after truancy charges and struggles with mental illness. He was incarcerated from the age of 16 to 19, was released 6 years ago, and is now working as a youth advocate and community organizer on youth incarceration issues. Rodney, I want to welcome you to Studio 2. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone.
Hello. And so, Rodney, you went into the system for truancy. I want to briefly get an understanding of your experience while in juvenile detention and how it impacted you.
So my experience while being incarcerated as a juvenile, I basically, as I heard some of the people that were already on the call mention, staff basically offering, you know, youth and kids food to engage in fights. I actually was in solitary confinement, so I was on lockdown for a minute while being in there and unable to call my mom or have any contact with my family, and even having a visit. And also, like, I feel like the food that we ate wasn't really, like, you're away, so you don't expect it to really be, like, good food, but I don't think it's something that, like, they should feed any human being. And it has impacted me. Well, I didn't allow it to affect me negatively. Unfortunately, they happens to a lot of individuals that go into the system. I allowed it to, you know, build me up, and I just started to, like, you know, read and go to, like, you know, different services that were in there and we were allowed to go to. And it has made me who I am today, as you mentioned, a community organizer and a youth advocate.
So, Rodney, that's interesting, right? Because you're mentioning that there was an opportunity for you, I guess, to reflect and to grow. Was that all, like, self-started? Were there things about the facility that helped you do that? Because that's the goal of sort of a rehabilitative incarceration.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the system or the detention center or anybody in there had anything to do with it. I feel like it was more of like a self thing, because I started to apply myself and read and just, like, you know, talk to my family more. And also, I read a lot, and I feel like that's what really changed my insight on things and was, like, building me up and allow me to thrive as a better person, to be a better person.
Yeah, and I think about you now on the outside, an advocate and community organizer helping young people. I want you to look in and tell us, what do you think is broken about this system that sort of keeps so many kids stuck in it?
You know, I feel like it's a lot to it, and I feel like they fall into, like, gentrification and capitalism and just, like, people not really having opportunities that are offered to others based on the color of their skin and where they come from. As far as, like, you know, I also heard someone, like, I also read and heard someone mention talk about fixing the system. I don't believe in systems, and I don't believe in incarcerating and locking up youth. So I don't, if I would say it's a way to fix it, I don't think there is, abolish it. I don't feel like it's a way to fix a system that has been built and their main goal is to dehumanize individuals, and specifically Black and colored individuals and minority communities. There's no fixing it. There's other things that can be built and other things that could be replaced other than incarcerating individuals. And I feel like if I was to say that I get ideas on fixing the system, that means I also am saying that I agree to youth being arrested and locked up, which I do not.
Yeah. Well, that is Rodney Gardner.
Thank you, Rodney.
Who was formerly incarcerated in the PJJSC. Thank you so much for your time, Rodney, on the program today.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
So we're going to talk a lot more about this on the other side of this break, including a conversation with a city council member who has been investigating this issue, has some ideas about how to reform it. Give us a call or a comment. What do you think are the alternatives to locking kids up? 888-477-9499, Studio 2 at WHYY.org. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Before we get back into our conversation about the problems with juvenile detention in our city, we want to tell you about our next Studio 2 on the Road event that is coming up tomorrow.
That's pretty soon, Cherry.
It's very soon. We're coming to Wilmington Thursday, May 22nd for a conversation with Mayor John Carney. He's been in politics in the state for over two decades, most recently, of course, serving as governor until he left that office in January.
So this is your chance to hear from Carney about what he's learned and about the pressing issues facing the state of Delaware, as well as his vision to revitalize Wilmington. Head to WHYY.org/events. That's WHYY.org/events to register.
Yeah, now back to our main topic. We're talking about the high rate of juvenile detention in Philadelphia with Samantha Malamed, investigative reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, whose ongoing series was part of why we decided to do this show.
Also with us is Nicole L., chief of the Children and Youth Justice Unit at the Defender Association of Philadelphia. And our question today is, should the city consider alternatives to incarcerating young people? And what would those alternatives be? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, or leave a comment in the YouTube chat. And we have a caller who has a suggestion right now on the line. This is Kate from South Jersey. Kate, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment?
Hi, I think that a lot of the reactions are really stopgap, and it's important for us to do things now to address some of the over-incarceration in comparison to other places. And I think it's important to note, too, that there are great people doing great work. So certainly there are things we can learn, best practices from other cities, but I think the most salient point really is looking at the picture holistically to be proactive. How do we go upstream and do things prior to getting to this point? And there, you know, is a lot of great work around that, but I think we have to consider that first, because as much as we're looking at some of the traumas that occur, there's a great deal of healing that can occur too when we look at it holistically and upstream.
Thank you so much, Kate in South Jersey.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments because we have quite a few. We have Maida who comments, make school experiences more interesting and relevant, uplift the quality of community life with family support to combat the entertainment industry's cultural depravity. She's blaming a lot of different things. Paul comments, locally, we need to encourage ground and grassroots neighborhood level cooperation, farming, resource banking, and basic education out of what schools offer. And Samantha, I wanted to ask you this. I mean, we just had the Philadelphia District Attorney's race. You know, very likely the incumbent Larry Krasner will be there for a third term. He talked about a lot of change. And in your reporting, you talked about there has been a lot of reform that has made a lot of headway, but there's also been some stagnation. Can you talk about that? What have you seen change? What has changed? And where are the sticking points?
So, I mean, obviously it's a huge justice system, and you know, the juvenile part is just a really small part of it. And some of that it's sort of hard to see into because those hearings are largely closed to the public. I mean, one area that we can see is direct file, which is where children are charged as adults. And we can see that they're still charging kids as adults. It really hasn't decreased. And a lot of those young people end up in a situation which the DA had said that he, you know, thought was coercive and he didn't want to continue, which is that if they want to get back to the juvenile system, they have to agree to plead guilty to go there. And so, you know, I think a lot of people are troubled by that. And, you know, a lot of those young people end up being held on a unit on in the adult jails on State Road. And, you know, there's obviously not the same access to programming and different things up there. And I don't, you know, I've heard that kids don't get outside that much up there. You hear about kids being held in solitary and, you know, about vermin infestations and things like that. So I think that, you know, in terms of what's being done on the juvenile side, I would defer to Nicole on that, how the DA's office has changed its policies there.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, Nicole, because certainly Krasner ran on a platform as a reformer in this area and other areas. At the same time, we saw this big uptick in gun violence in Philadelphia, and we heard from the DA's office that they were looking at, you know, relatively small groups of individuals who were perpetuating or caught in these cycles of violence, many of them young people. And my sense was they wanted to disrupt those very aggressively. Is that what ended up changing their posture on this, you think? Or did they change their posture on this? Give me a sense of what you think changed and why you think it changed.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, we can all agree that Mr. Krasner came in touting a lot of change in the system generally. However, the change that we've seen has mostly applied to the adult side. Mm. We are not seeing a lot of change or momentum happening on the juvenile side. And I think it's easier to focus on the adult side because for a lot of people, even people within the district attorney's office, juvenile is like its own system that mm-hmm. if you're not working in it on the daily, then you don't really know about what's happening in the courtroom. So you don't know what policies need to be changed.
Right.
So we would love to see more momentum on juvenile justice reform within the district attorney's office and the way that they're treating these cases in the courtroom, because we have not seen that thus far.
So you think the explanation is they're just not focusing on it because it's sort of an obscure system, it doesn't account for the majority of cases, ergo it kind of gets put on the back burner? Or is there something that changed on the ground that you think made them reconsider those reforms just based on what was happening in Philadelphia at the time?
I mean, I have to be honest that I started working in juvenile in 2009, and we're here in 2025, and I cannot say that I have seen in wow. those years much progress on the juvenile justice wow. side. And while, for example, the district attorney's office has published on the internet a set of standards that they say are supposed to apply to juvenile cases, this is how we should treat these cases, you don't actually see that happening in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. The day-to-day district attorney, so the average, we call them baby DAs, the young DAs who are handling cases in court, don't even know that that exists, even though it's on the internet for the public to know.
So wait, you're saying that there's a disconnect between the actual policies of the office and those who work in the office not knowing those policies exist or somehow not executing on them?
Yes, they don't know that the policies exist, but even the policies themselves are not, like, they're old. Mm. I mean, we're not seeing a lot of changes on the juvenile side like we're seeing on the adult side. It's just, it has been pretty stagnant.
Wow. So, I mean, before we're going to bring in another guest, but I don't want to miss this in case we run out of time. Samantha, you, in your reporting, you dug into the 200-year history of confinement of young people going back to something called the House of Refuge in 1825. Mm-hmm. And as I read through that timeline, I didn't see many hopeful examples of like how to do this well, how to rehabilitate young people who have contact with the criminal justice system. So I'll put it to you, Nicole. What does reform or a solution look like to you?
I mean, obviously, we have to stop focusing on incarceration. We know about the harms of incarceration, especially on a group of children, for example, children from the city of Philadelphia, who already have a significant trauma history. So you have like almost a third of kids who also have dependency cases, meaning that they have family issues that are going on outside of their involvement in the delinquency system. And so punishing those kids, incarcerating those kids, we already know doesn't work. But what we can do is we can build up the community supports that are really helpful to these kids. So providing them with mentors. We have people who are working in programs like, for example, a program called PIAP, where they have mostly male, because most of the system is male, but mostly male people who come out, take the kids bowling, take them to community events, help them with their homework. And we know that kids really like programs like that. They like having, quite frankly, a lot of the men in their lives who can support them, who can answer their questions, and who actually care about what's going on in their day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. We hear kids saying, like, that person actually asked me how my day was going. And for them, that is enough that they are willing to not go and engage with older peers who they're trying to get attention from. Like, they have this male mm-hmm. role model who is good for them, who is not encouraging them to engage in crimes. But another issue that we are seeing is the complete focus on placement and the kind of disregard for the fact that statistics show that more than 4 months of placement is actually negative for kids. But Philadelphia will incarcerate kids for 9 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. Once we start looking at the programs that we're sending kids to, mm-hmm. I think that we're going to see a significant decrease in recidivism.
Yeah. In addition to decarceration, mm-hmm. though, how should these placements be run? Because what's confusing to me is that you've got some cities run stuff, and then you have private contractors who are running, and it seems like no one's doing all that better than anyone else. And so you're kind of left with a sense of, well, what is there left to change? You've sort of tried private, public. You end up sort of, your head starts spinning. I mean, what should placements look like?
Well, regardless of who is running them, yeah. you have to look at the programs themselves. I think everybody would agree that evidence-based programs, so programs that we know work, should be incorporated into these facilities, but that's not what happens. The facilities create their own programs. It doesn't really matter whether or not they're evidence-based. They will say, you know, this is the program that everybody has to follow. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter why you're there. They're not individually tailored to the actual needs of the child. And so if you are not tailoring programs to what the children's actual needs are, then those programs are going to be ineffective.
Yeah. I want to bring in our final guest. We've been talking about this hour, all the things that are going on in the Juvenile Detention Center here in Philadelphia. And a person who has been very outspoken is Councilmember Jamie Gauthier, and she is on the line right now. Councilmember Jamie Gauthier, you're on Studio 2. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Cherry. Thank you for having me.
And so we only have a few minutes left in the show, but I know you've probably been listening to some of the solutions that Nicole L. laid out here. What do you think the city can do to sort of help, you know, I guess, usher in some reforms so that we can move away from the overcrowding, the abuse, all the different things that we've been seeing in our local juvenile justices detention center?
Sure. Well, I do think that the city has to fully cooperate with the state in its investigation. But I also want to see other things. I am fighting to expand the city's youth ombuds office, which provides oversight over congregate care facilities that house our youth. Right now, that department is underfunded and it's not enshrined in the city charter. So that's something I'm fighting for this budget season. And I expect to introduce legislation that will make that office permanent. I also want to see us get away from sending young people to detention. Last week, I was in Harrisburg with council colleagues and with state colleagues advocating for a $50 million expansion for post-arrest youth diversion across Pennsylvania. We know that diversion works. We see much less recidivism. Diversion keeps crime down. Diversion helps people to get restitution faster, and it's a lot cheaper than detention. While detention can cost upwards of $350,000, the most expansive diversion program that we know of is $10,000. And so I think what we're seeing going on at TJJSC and with DHS overall and the troubles we've been having with the state. The state is not blameless in all of this. It just points to how the juvenile justice system has repeatedly failed our young people. And I think we have to look for other alternatives that will really help young people get on the path they need to be on.
And Councilmember Gauthier, as we wrap up here, I want to ask you, I know the JJSC is in your district, and do you think that there is the political will? Because that's one thing Samantha said early in the show, is that there hasn't been the political will to make the type of reforms necessary. Nicole has said she hasn't seen any reforms over the years she's been in it. Does the political will exist right now? And we have about a minute left, so if you could keep it tight.
I think we have to curate the political will. That's why the reporting that Samantha has done has been extraordinary. The youth ombuds, even in their current form, has also done investigations or done reporting that's offered sunlight. I think sunlight and pressure gets us to political will. I don't think the political will is going to come on its own.
Real quick, you said you want the city to cooperate with the state investigation. Do you believe they are cooperating?
I'm still, you know, we talked to the city solicitor this morning. The city solicitor says that they are. Clearly, there is a lot of miscommunication between the state and the city on this issue. And I'm waiting for more details, but also encouraging both partners to step up to the task of keeping our young people safe.
That is Jamie Gauthier, council member representing West Philadelphia. Thank you so much for your time. And let me thank our other guests this hour. Samantha Melamed, investigative reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer, whose work helped inspire this episode. And Nicole L., chief of the Children and Youth Justice Unit at the Defender Association of Philadelphia. Thanks to you both for your time this hour.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yes, and a lot of great comments. We didn't get to them all. And thank you for our caller for today. Again, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 at WHYY right here in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
Before I say my name, I will also note one more time that we did invite the District Attorney's Office and DHS to join the show today, but they declined. And now my name. It's still coming. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks so much for joining us. We will talk to you again tomorrow.